a gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
All right, welcome to Inside Sources, the fastest couple of hours in radio. And this is your this is your host, Derek Brown. I'm here with my co-host and good friend, Leah Murray.
And it's always a pleasure to be with you, Derek.
And it is so much fun. Usually we do the night show.
I know.
And so today
they brought us in today.
They did. We're channeling our inner Boyd.
We're going to try.
We'll try.
I don't think we'll ever achieve inner Boyd status, but we're going to work on
possibly.
It.
Possibly. This is one step closer. And there is so much going on. And in fact, one of the biggest news stories that a lot of you have seen, which if you haven't been following it, it will impact your life slightly. And that is the change in election days that will be coming up. So we have a member of Congress, Chris Stewart, who has announced that he is officially... We knew last week he was going to be announcing his... you know, he'd be stepping down from Congress. And, you know, which is... It's tragic. He's done a great job, very committed to Utah. And for health reasons of his wife, he says, I'm going to be stepping down. Now, that sent sort of a shockwave through the political community. Because number one, you have people who... Right? People who want to run...
But, right. So I feel like a lot of the stories have been about who's going to run for the seat. How are they going to campaign? But I think more interesting, maybe shockwave, is when the timeline came out, Derek, they changed all the municipal elections.
Exactly.
Right. So we're not just planning a special election to replace Representative Chris Stewart. All these people who are running in city offices for city councils and for mayors all across the state. Now their elections have changed as well, right?
It's exactly
across the whole
spectrum.
So
if you're running a campaign, I mean, this is a major event that takes, you know, most campaigns are planned 6 to 12 months in advance. You have timelines, you have things you need to do and stuff that goes out in the mail. I mean, you've got a lot going on, and to have that kind of changed midstream
must be hard.
It's hard. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
And so we've got someone on the line who for whom this will have an impact and can talk with a degree of, you know, personal experience about what this happened, you know, what this looks like. And so we have with us Ben Adalski. Ben currently represents District 4 in Ogden. He's running to be Ogden's mayor. And we're thrilled to have Ben on with us. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate the opportunity.
So first of all, I want to say your bio has what has to be the coolest phrase.
Yeah, we like this line, Ben.
Lee and I have been just giggling about this. Your biography, you know, your bio online, I just have to read it because it's not every day you hear this. It says, until, let's see here, after graduating from Weber State University with a degree in criminal justice in 2000, Ben was jumping from helicopters and wrestling elk for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. Is this true? You got to, before we start, you got to tell us what that means, because that's got to be one of the best, resume statements I think I've ever heard.
That statement is 100% true. Just before that, I was picking up dead animals off the side of the road, and that earned me an opportunity to jump out of helicopters and wrestle elk. So,
I love that.
And why did you ever stop? Yeah. It seems to me that would be the greatest job ever. Of course, it probably some hazard pay. But...
Yeah. It was the greatest job ever, but it's been part and parcel of the greatest career ever.
Oh,
so I'm still with the Division of Wildlife Resources, and now I oversee day-to-day operations in northern Utah. And have had a whole bunch of experiences between then and as being a biologist and river restoration expert and working with local communities, and even got to work with the governor's public lands office and various policy issues and oversaw legislative affairs as well. So it's been an interesting career and journey.
I love that. All right, Ben, to let me focus us on what we wanted to talk to you about was, what was your initial reaction to the news about the date changes around the municipal elections?
Well, certainly my initial reaction was uncertainty. But have you ever seen a winning campaign that is static? I haven't, right? So you mentioned in the intro that there's a lot of planning that goes into a campaign, and it's true. But one of the things that you plan for is uncertainty, and this is certainly one of those. So we can look at this from the negative light, because it does change timelines. It does change when we vote and when we do certain things and strategies. But at the same time, it's an opportunity for us to share our message for a couple weeks more, for us to get in front of more voters for a couple more weeks, to get caught up in some of the timelines that we planned for and might be falling behind on. So I see a lot of silver linings. But more importantly, and most important, is that representation is the thing that matters. And if we make these adjustments in our campaigns, it gives Utah, and especially the 2nd Congressional District, an opportunity to be represented. Because with current law, the way I understood it, if we didn't make these changes as candidates and campaigns, we would be leaving the 2nd Congressional District, and therefore a big part of Utah, without representation where it matters and when it matters. So to me, I think this is a small adjustment that we can make so that we can accommodate a really important and big priority for all of us, which is representation.
That's great. And, you know, I love that attitude. And yeah. I'll tell you why. I served, and I'm still kind of suffering from the PTSD of this, but I served as the chairman of the Utah Republican Party for a number of years, and it was right during COVID. And so when COVID happened, you have all these major governor campaigns that had been in the works, some of them for years, millions of dollars on the line. And all of a sudden, like overnight, their campaigns that they thought they were going to run, all of a sudden, they didn't. Right, Leah? I mean, that's kind of what happened. And so and what I loved about this is, as much as a lot of them were complaining, I said to the delegates who were going to be voting for these folks, I said, listen, if there's one hallmark of a good elected official, it's someone who can look at things the way Ben just said, which is, look, life is not static.
And
right?
I love that.
It is dynamic. It changes all the time. And if you want someone who knows what they're doing, someone who's going to be good in public office, it's someone who can pivot quickly, change with adjusting circumstances, and go a different route. And so you got all these campaigns. And I would say to these delegates, I said, look, this is your time to watch them. Like they're in a real life crisis, and as like the governor of our state, there's going to be many more to come. Watch closely how she or he responds right now. So anyway, Ben, I really appreciate that attitude, because for those of you who don't know, the primary is now September the 5th, and the general is November the 21st, which is basically, what is that, Leah, pushing him back about 2 weeks?
Couple weeks,
each?
Yeah. So, Ben, I feel like one of your pitches is going to be what Derek just gave you. I am totally adaptable and agile. When there's some kind of crisis, I'm ready to go. But can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what your pitch is to voters? Like, why would people want to vote for you up in Ogden?
Absolutely. So to get back to that first point, I think we all have our crosses to bear, and I think chronic optimism might be one of mine. But I think it's really important, because we need to be optimistic about our future. Because there's plenty to be optimistic about, but there's also a lot to be distracted by in the news and in the media and so on. But people are really frustrated with that. And they want us to put our priorities where they matter. And for us, for me, through my service in the city council and through my campaign for mayor, I want to make our people our priority. I want to make sure that our priorities are the priorities that they have on the day-to-day. And so I feel that if we are putting our priorities in that place, that we are putting our attention and our resources right where it matters the most, so that our families and our kids and our people of our community can be their best selves. And most importantly, too, is that as we look to where we're making our investments, we're going to need to be making decisions and governing in the day-to-day, but we want to make sure that we're always future-focused, and I think the best way that we can focus on the future is to make sure that we're focusing on our kids.
I would say, what are some of the issues now you're dealing with in Ogden? I mean, Ogden has some, you know, it's got some unique challenges, and it's growing like crazy. And the Ogden I see today is so different from the Ogden I saw 10 or 20 years ago. So in the last minute we've actually only got about 30 seconds. Give us the quick rundown of what you see the biggest challenges are.
Well, I'm glad you see the difference, because it didn't happen by accident. Those differences were made by people. And so the things that we need to continue to focus on are making sure that we have infrastructure that connects our neighborhoods and our schools and our churches, to make sure we've got educational opportunities for our kids and for our families, to make sure we have recreation opportunities for our kids, make sure we have safe streets and safe neighborhoods with police and fire that's second to none. And we can pay for all of those things by providing the economic prosperity that we need to pay those bills. So the jobs, the businesses, the small businesses, the people that work in those places, helping us create the prosperity and the economic engine to pay for those opportunities to make our people the best that they can be.
All right, Ben Nadolski, running for office up in Mayor. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. So, Derek, coming up after the break, I want to keep talking about the special election, not just about how it affects municipal races, but also what's going on.
There's a lot out there right now.
Yeah.
This changes a lot of things.
Okay. Stay with us after the break.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Get deeper insights on the news from inside sources.
Welcome back. You're here with me, Leah Murray, and my good friend Derek Brown as we chat about all the most interesting things that are happening today. And we have got with us fabulous KSL News Radio reporter Lindsay Ertz to give us all the deets. Spill the tea, Lindsay.
I call her the indomitable.
Oh, my gosh. I get a different adjective every time.
I'm sorry. Do you like fabulous or indomitable better?
Keep going. Give me some more. I don't know.
It's a multiple choice question, is it?
Yeah, there's one
right answer. Award-winning? Taylor calls me award-winning.
Oh, I like that.
There we go.
Oh, Taylor won.
And Lindsay has been dogging on this issue. There's no one right now in Utah who knows more about the issue we're about to talk about than Lindsay Ertz. So tell us, first of all, for those who haven't been following, what is the what's the big issue with elections and the dates changing and how this impacts actually quite a bit going forward this year?
Yeah, the whole state, really. Okay, so most people know that Chris Stewart is resigning. He's resigning on September 15th, and we now have to fill his seat. We're doing that by special election, but the whole drama has been, when are we holding the special election? We now know that we are holding the special election on November 21st. We are holding this special election primary before that on September 5th, but in order to do that, we had to push back all of Utah's city's elections. So those city elections will also now be on September 5th and November 21st.
And so, Lindsay, tell us why did they have to do that? Couldn't they just sort of follow the law as it currently is written?
Yeah, so Utah has a special election law. This is a law that was put in after Jason Chaffetz resigned in 2017. It dictates the process for when we can hold special elections. And in that law, it has basically a 180-day window and dictates that we can only hold the election on certain existing election days. A municipal election is not one of those. A municipal primary is not one of those. And this window is also 180 days. And so if we follow the law currently, if the legislature does nothing, the law as it stands right now would mean we wouldn't be able to hold this election until November of this year, early November for a primary, and March of next year for the general. So that, because we know Chris Stewart is stepping down September 15th, that would leave the seat vacant from September all the way until March of 2024. And clearly Republican leadership in this state was not on board with that.
Right.
So,
and my hunch is that Republican leadership at the national level was not on board.
Yeah, right.
They've only got a 5-vote majority. I'm sure they weren't thrilled to know that that would be four.
Right, right, exactly. So what we are doing is we are pushing the municipal elections back a few weeks. We are holding this special election for this second congressional district seat on the same days. Again, it's September 5th and November 21st. The legislature has to go into special session. They've now been called by the governor to go into special session to change this law. They're going to shorten the timeline, and they're also going to probably add language that says we can now hold special elections on municipal primary days, because the law right now doesn't say that.
Gotcha. All right. So you're talking about the word primary. Makes me want to just ask this question. So are the people who have registered for a party, Lindsay, kind of stuck with that choice for this primary that's coming up? Or could people be now making their party decisions in preparation for a primary they weren't expecting? Because remember, the congressional one's going to be a party primary, whereas municipal would not have been.
Right. Okay, so let's think through this a little bit. Let me just state for the record, I'm working on a story on this for tomorrow morning. So your question is ultimately, can people switch parties at this point?
Yeah, let's
right?
go with that.
Yeah, that is your question. Can you register as any party right now? So in a typical election, in a regular general election that we hold at regular times, Utah's law stipulates when you can register and when you need to affiliate with a political party. And I believe the dates are in there. I think if the election's going to – Derek, you know those.
Well, I actually just got a text from Representative Jordan Tusher who passed this bill. And he said it's April 1st. So the date is actually set in code, except he said in presidential election years – there's a bill they passed that moves it to the day after the filing deadline. But apparently this doesn't really...
No, this doesn't apply.
Yeah. So
because
I think
it's a
that
special
be,
election.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
So he was just saying that may be one of the... That's one of the reasons that it may be part of what we're going to see next week in the special election.
So are they going to change that?
I didn't yet because I just got the text. This is how
we gather news.
But you'll know tomorrow, Lindsay, right? So we'll figure it out.
I will work to figure this out before tomorrow. But essentially what Derek is finding out and what we are kind of talking about on the fly here is that in a typical election where we were electing a president or it was a midterm election, you could not switch your party affiliation after the filing deadline. But because this is a special election, those rules don't apply, it sounds like. I'm going to get that confirmed, but it sounds like that law does not apply to this election.
Well, and here's what makes Lindsay's job infinitely more difficult as a reporter, is it's one thing to report what the law says.
Yeah.
It's another thing for you to also have to speculate what the law might be
next week.
Next week at this time, because I think it's almost guaranteed it will be different.
Yeah. Well, that is a big question I have right now is, will you change this law to make sure people can't party switch, right? Because that is something that particularly the Republican Party in Utah has been concerned about, kind of trying to quote unquote what they call game the system and register as a, we know this is a heavily Republican state, you register as a Republican, you can vote in their closed primary. So this CD2 race will be a closed primary for Republicans, so you'll need to be a registered Republican to vote. That's what we do know. The question at this point is, can you still register as a Republican? Is there any deadline on when you can affiliate with the Republican Party?
Okay, so Lindsay, it's going to be a closed primary. There's going to be some names on that ballot. Can you tell us who all is officially in?
Yes.
Who we're expecting to see in?
Yes.
Go.
What I can tell you right now is I have confirmed with Greg Hughes. I have confirmed with Derek Huff. I have confirmed...
Bruce Huff.
Sorry.
Not the dancer.
Derek is the dancer. Sorry, that was a slip of the tongue.
That was funny.
Bruce Huff.
She's a groupie, clearly.
Okay, right. I clearly am a fan. And also... Maybe that's
maybe
how people best
know
him, know.
Maybe
right?
We should let him know, too.
And that's maybe how people best know Bruce Huff, is he's the dad of Derek and Julianne Huff.
But he's
right?
also the Republican National Committee man, and he was the chair of the party. So in the Republican circles, he's very well known.
He's well known in the party, but maybe not as much broad name recognition. So sorry, Bruce Huff, Greg Hughes. I just talked to Jordan Hess. He's the current the vice chair of the Republican Party. He says he does intend to gather signatures. So that means he's likely to be in. He just hasn't done it yet.
I think he's going to file. I don't think he's going to gather signatures.
Sorry. Gosh, I'm misspeaking all over the place.
I wanted to be clear because I think that's something for him that's probably a big deal. He also lives in the St. George area, which is kind of an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, and that's a thing for him. I didn't mean to say gather signatures. I meant to say intends to file, declare his candidacy. So There's that. Who have I missed?
Becky Edwards
has already declared with me previously before the schedule came out. I have not spoken to her today, but she told me she was in no matter what. So unless she's changed her mind, she hasn't said that. But we're assuming she's still in. And then on the Democratic side.
Oh, wait. Todd Weiler.
Okay. Todd Weiler, I talked to this morning. He said if he decides to run, he will make it known next Wednesday. He intends, if he decides to run, he will file next Wednesday. And that is the same day as the legislative session. There's some trickiness there because the legislature has to vote on this law. So it's kind of like, is that a conflict if you are also running in the race? We don't really know the answer to that question either. So something else to look into.
Interesting.
But on the Democrat side, you have State Senator Kathleen Reby, who I just spoke with today, and she is running for this race. And there are some other names rumored on the Democrat side. So we'll see who else jumps in, because I do want to point out that candidates have between today and next Wednesday to file.
Oh, my gosh.
Did I get it?
I think you got it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think if you're not following Lindsay Ehrets on Twitter,
you need to,
because the latest breaking news in Utah politics is always there. That's who I literally have. That's who I have on my computer.
It's kind of a sickness at this point. It's just like, if I know it, I'll tweet it. So, I mean, yeah, there's that.
Do you have any sense real fast, Lindsay, about how maybe any of the municipal candidates across the states, how their feelings, you know?
Yeah, I think it's certainly a shift for them. And I think maybe it depends on which side of the aisle you're on. Okay. If you're a Democratic city candidate, you're probably like, cool, you just moved my elections and you don't really care about how it impacts my life. On the Republican side, it sounds like more Republican candidates understand why this is happening.
Exactly. All right, Lindsay Ehrets, KSL Indomitable News Reporter, thank you for joining us. And stay with us through the break. We'll be right back.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
All right, welcome back to Inside Sources. Here filling in for Boyd Matheson, I am Derek Brown with my good friend and co-host, Leah Murray.
It is always fun to have elevated conversation with you, Derek.
Absolutely. Likewise, there's a lot going on. We just got through talking to KSL's reporter, Lindsay Ehrets, about sort of the massive upheaval that's taking place in the election world. So much
right.
So that the law is going to be changed next week. It impacts every municipal election across the state. And for those of you who are registered voters, you will be getting ballots, but they'll be coming later than they otherwise would.
Right. And I love how sometimes I think people think we're always talking about elections, and the answer is yes, because they're always coming, right? So right now there's all sorts of news about what's happening in our state elections and in Congressional District 2, but there's also all sorts of information about what's happening at the national level in the 2024 presidential election, Derek, because people are planning, right? So candidates are getting ready to run.
They need to, that's why it feels like there's always an election
right.
in place.
Right.
And sometimes you have announcements of people running for president that are surprising. Yesterday we had an unsurprising one because we were sort of expecting it, and that is Mike Pence.
Right. I want to say Tuesday night, you and I on KSL at night said we expected him to announce, and I feel like he heard us.
And
the
next
day he
exactly.
did.
He must listen to KSL.
He absolutely
So Pence was here in Utah just a little over a month ago. He spoke to a large crowd for a lunch event. He had some other things. In fact, he was on Inside Sources
right.
as part of that visit. And, you know, it was really interesting. He did a great job of fielding some difficult questions. He didn't shy away from things like January 6th, Donald Trump, and that sort of thing. But part of me also feels like at that time we saw this, what appeared to be kind of a surge by DeSantis.
Right.
And I got the impression sitting there that he was trying to say, if you don't like Trump and you're not a big fan of DeSantis, I'm the candidate. I think he was trying to paint himself as the alternative.
Right. And so last night he's on CNN because they're doing these town halls. Listeners maybe remember, former President Trump was on one of these town halls as well. And he was asked about this question about the former president and about January 6th.
Just to be clear, are you saying that a vote for Donald Trump is a vote against the Constitution?
When the president asserted that I had the right to overturn the election, I said today that I felt that he was asking me to choose between him and the Constitution. I chose the Constitution. I said today, President Trump was wrong then, he's wrong now.
And, you know, he was asked the same question here in Utah.
Right.
And he made it every bit as clear, like, I chose the Constitution. And, in fact, at that event he spoke at, he got a standing ovation at that moment.
Right.
So he's not shying away from that issue and may, in fact, be sort of putting some distance between himself and the sort of hardcore supporters of President Trump.
Right. And I also thought it was interesting. CNN's Dana Bash asked about whether he would pardon January 6 rioters.
Donald Trump says he is, quote, inclined to pardon many members of the mob who attacked the Capitol on January 6. Those people were, of course, part of the same mob who built gallows and chanted about wanting to hang you. Would you consider pardoning any of them?
You know, on the day of January 6, I issued a tweet demanding that people leave the Capitol and end the violence. And I said that those that failed to do that should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. And I continue to believe that today. We cannot ever allow what happened on January 6 to happen again in the heart of our democracy. And I'll stand by the decisions and the due process of court in our laws. And I have no interest or no intention of pardoning those that assaulted police officers vandalized our Capitol. They need to be answerable to the law.
So, Lee, I think that we're seeing a pattern of questioning. I mean,
right.
He is going to have to sort of account for or answer where he is on just about anything involving Donald Trump. In fact, right now, there's a lot of investigations going on, right?
That's
and
right.
So that was the next thing they asked him is, okay, there's a lot of investigations, particularly into the president. What are your impressions on those?
Now more than ever, we ought to be finding ways we could actually come together.
And, sir, we're going to get
and
to
this
all
kind of this kind of action by the Department of Justice, I think, would only fuel further division in the country. And let me also say, I think it would also send a terrible message to the wider world. I hope the DOJ thinks better of it and resolves these issues without an indictment.
Sir, I just want to clarify what you're saying is that if they believe he committed a crime, they should not go forward with an indictment.
Let me be clear that no one's above the law. But with regard to the unique circumstances here, I had no business having classified documents in my residence, and I took full responsibility for it. President Biden had no business having them in his residence from when he was vice president as well. And the same with former President Trump. We've got to find a way to move our country forward and restore confidence in equal treatment under the law in this country. We really do.
So I'm wondering, like, what do you think? So let me just push you a little bit, Derek, right? So if you're a Republican
good thing
in
no
Utah,
one's listening while you're
that's
pushing
right, let
over
me just
here.
Push you politely. Elevated conversation,
exactly.
Right? So then they gave him a standing ovation around the Constitution when you said that he was here in Utah a little bit ago. Would they be cheering for the same thing here? Like, would Utah Republican voters who would be in a primary when Mike Pence is running against, you know, the former president, are they going to feel as good about what his answer is right there on whether the president should be indicted?
Well, that's a good question because he's talking specifically about the documents.
Right.
Right. And that's it is really tricky. And you and I have talked about this a little on KSL at night. I mean, it is odd for me to see how someone could have classified documents in their residence. I've worked in D.C. I've seen how generally these things are handled and the way classified documents are distributed and then carried back. You don't inadvertently walk out of these secure locations with these kind of documents. So I think what he's saying is it's a systemic problem. And if you're going to get mad at one, you got to get mad at all. So let's fix the problem.
Right. And not have it be looking like in the middle of an election, we're trying to restore confidence, trying to be a world leader. Let's not have it look like a political witch hunt. I mean, I'm just a little suspicious, Derek. I'm just going to tell you, like, a kid in Massachusetts had these documents that he dumps on his Discord server. So a little
so
bit.
Where
I don't,
did he get them?
Right. I'm not sure the former vice president, is wrong that there's some systemic flaws, right, that needs to be addressed.
Exactly. And I'll tell you that the big question then about Trump came next, and that is, would you pardon Trump? And this is the question, or this is the response, sort of, that he gave to that answer.
If Donald Trump is convicted of a crime and you're elected president, would you pardon him?
Well, I don't want to speak about hypotheticals. I'm not sure I'm going to be elected president of the United States. But I believe we have a fighting chance. I really believe we do.
And if you are?
And I would hope, again, Dana, I, You're as persistent as ever. CNN is living up to its reputation. But look, there are real issues the American people are facing. And rather than talking about that, I want to talk about what the people here in Iowa are talking about, which is the failed policies of the Biden administration.
Oh, I think he's right. Don't you think? I mean, to a certain extent, if I'm running for office and I want to be looking forward, right? I should not be answering questions about what I might do. I don't know. Derek, tell me.
There's no indictment. There's a lot of issues that are have yet to be decided. So I think it's smart of him to say, essentially, you know, I'm gonna put that on hold.
Yeah, and there's no right answer. He's just gonna get in trouble.
Exactly. Right. All right. Well, and what's interesting is he also specifically divided himself or separated himself with the former president on a number of issues.
Yeah.
And like Social Security and immigration. And so it remains to be seen kind of what happens.
Yeah. So stay with us after the break. We'll be chatting about a very interesting, I think surprising decision handed down today from the Supreme Court about congressional redistricting.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources. Today, I, Leah Murray, and my good friend Derek Brown are sitting in for Boyd Matheson, but we will try to keep dividing rage from reason.
Exactly.
And,
keep the conversation elevated,
that's right,
as Boyd likes to say.
We will behave like Boyd would want us to. So, June is one of my favorite months, Derek, for many reasons, but one of them, because I'm a nerd, is that this is when Supreme Court cases are going to start coming down, right?
So we're or the big ones.
That's right.
Right. They save the biggies till June.
Probably because they've been working on them, right?
Exactly.
For months, and they have to write these opinions. They're going to go into case law, you know, like forever, right? So today, big court case. Supreme Court struck down Republican-drawn congressional districts in Alabama that civil rights activists there had said discriminated against black voters. And we are surprised, right, Derek, because we've got conservative Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts with this decision, and also conservative Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, that's interesting.
In addition to the three liberal justices on the court. So interesting, right? My whole Twitter feed blew up. Like, this is really where our surprise that this happened.
And I love seeing Supreme Court cases where you don't have them drawn along sort of the traditional political or ideological lines, because that shows there's more going on. Now, when it comes to drawing maps, this is always a controversial issue. And
right,
let's just call it what it is. There are spoils of victory.
Right.
And the reality is, I mean, here in Utah, maps were drawn and the congressional maps made it much more difficult for a Democrat to win at the congressional seat. And that's not unlike other states. Like Illinois, I mean, the Democrat legislature in Illinois drew their maps such that no Republican's probably ever going to win, you know, a seat in Illinois.
For the rest of time.
Forever.
You're right.
And so the question is that fair? Well, the Supreme Court has basically said, look, you can draw them how you want, but there are certain things you can't do. And I think today's court case is touching on one of those things you can't do.
So we've got with us Doug Spencer, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Colorado and an election law scholar who studies the role of prejudice and racial attitudes in voting rights. So what Derek just said, those things you were talking about party, this case was about race and black voters. Welcome to the show, Professor Spencer.
Hi, thanks, Lee and Derek. It's nice to be here.
So give us, first of all, correct anything that we've said is wrong, you know, but give us the background or the context to this case and why it's such a big deal.
Yeah, I think it really is a big deal, and you've set it up really nicely. What's different about this case than what was going on in Utah and the Redistricting Commission, as you pointed out, is that this case is about race discrimination instead of partisan discrimination. And a really big difference between those two is that Congress passed a law in 1965, the Voting Rights Act, to specifically set out a framework for what you can and can't do when it comes to sorting people by race. And no such statute exists in the context of partisanship and party. And so today we have a Supreme Court, the majority opinion endorses the Voting Rights Act as enacted in 1965 and said states can't continue to ignore the rules of that act as Alabama tried to do this last redistricting cycle.
So, Professor, just to be clear, you mentioned that there are obviously the rules against discrimination based on race, but not necessarily on party. And so in politics, just because you can do something doesn't mean you necessarily should do it. But are you saying that that as far as drawing maps, if you want to draw them in a partisan way to block out a particular, you know, folks or an area that tends to have a centralized political party to weaken that party, that's totally permissible under federal law?
It's permissible under the U.S. Constitution and under federal law. There's nothing that prevents a state from, as you said, to the victor go the spoils of a winning coalition drawing districts to minimize the voice of its partisan opponents. There's nothing explicitly that prevents that.
Okay, because I'm not saying it should be done necessarily, but it does happen, and I think every state sees this, and there's always complaining and people saying it's unconstitutional. So I just want to make clear that that's not unconstitutional, right. But it also sometimes doesn't pass the smell test. And so that's the trick.
That's exactly right. And a state legislature could always step in and create standards. The federal Congress has never done so, and the U.S. Constitution doesn't create limits. But that doesn't stop a state from enacting a constitutional amendment or a redistricting commission or passing its own laws.
All right, Professor Spencer, go political with me for just a second. So we've got conservative Justice Roberts and conservative Justice Kavanaugh siding with our three liberal justices. Can you talk to us about, I feel like Roberts and Kavanaugh weren't siding with Sotomayor, Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, right? Because of ideology. So tell us what their arguments were that saw us see conservatives voting with our liberal justices.
Yeah, I think the biggest surprise for me is Chief Justice Roberts, because he's been so skeptical of the Voting Rights Act since he was a lawyer in the Justice Department in the 1980s in the Reagan administration. But ultimately, what draws them into the majority of this case is that this is a statute that Congress passed, and they both have a lot of deference for our political branches and are very skeptical about courts stepping in and telling our political branches what to do. And they also have more respect, I think, for the precedent of the Supreme Court than other conservative justices like Justice Thomas or Justice Alito. And they recognize that the Supreme Court has endorsed and upheld the Voting Rights Act in dozens and dozens of cases since it was enacted in 1965. And what they were asked to do in this case was basically to throw out all of those cases, and they were hesitant to do so.
So for those of you just tuning in, we have Professor Doug Spencer, who's an associate professor of law at the University of Colorado and someone who has studied this issue. And one of the things we haven't really dug into yet, Professor, is so what is it that the court actually said? They said this map or the drawing of the map is impermissible. And why is that? What is it that makes it such that, I mean, you mentioned earlier, you know, they don't want to necessarily be telling other branches what to do. In this case, the judiciary did exactly that. Tell us why.
So the Voting Rights Act says that minority populations, these are race and ethnic minority groups, have the right to be represented in their legislatures in rough proportion to their population. And Alabama, this is a case challenging a map that was drawn for its congressional districts. Alabama has 7 members of Congress, so there were 7 districts to draw. The black population in Alabama is 27%. Alabama drew its districts in a way that afforded black voters an opportunity to elect their own candidates in 1 out of the 7 districts. And the complaint was that because the population was 27%, which is almost 2/7, that Alabama should have drawn a second opportunity district for black voters. The state of Alabama said, we're not going to do that, even though the Voting Rights Act says we probably should. But we don't agree with the Voting Rights Act. And they challenged that, and the Supreme Court took the case. And many of us observed, why would the Supreme Court take that case unless they wanted to overturn the Voting Rights Act, because the case was a very straightforward application. And what the Supreme Court did today was just affirm its commitment to the Voting Rights Act and told Alabama, you need to go back and draw a map that has 2 opportunity districts for black voters.
All right, Professor Spencer, we've got like a minute left. Can you tell us, I think the court's considering another case related to states' abilities enforcing federal election laws. When you expect that decision, what you think is going to happen there, given that you're surprised by what happened here, anything you're watching this month coming out of SCOTUS?
So that other case, Moore versus Harper, would give state legislatures a lot more authority to determine the rules of elections. Based on what we heard in oral arguments, it seems that they're very skeptical to give state legislatures a blank check, which is what they've been asked to do. but also the case arose in North Carolina from a state Supreme Court opinion that has since been overturned. So I actually expect that opinion to be dismissed as moot or to be very, very, very limited because the ultimate controversy has disappeared since they first heard that case.
Fantastic. All right, Professor Doug Spencer, University of Colorado, thank you for joining us on Inside Sources.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Next, we've got someone in studio who I won't say who it is, but let's say it's someone who has not gotten much sleep the last week, and there's a good reason for that.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, your all-day companion for news. Inside Sources. Inside Sources. America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson. On Utah's home for elevated conversation. Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
All right, welcome to the second hour of Inside Sources. It is great to be with you. I am Derek Brown with my good friend and co-host today, Leah Murray. We're filling in for Boyd.
We are, and we're hoping to also be America's voice of reason when we chat for the next hour.
Exactly. As Boyd likes to say, he encourages us to dig a little deeper, think a little bigger, explore a little wider, and challenge our assumptions and disagree a little better.
Yeah. So, and I think we do that well.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. And if we don't, they won't invite us back.
That's right. So, someone will tell us.
It's a win-win. All right. We have in studio a good friend of ours and somebody who hasn't slept much and is probably very caffeinated. And we'll explain why. This is Robert Axon, who is the chairman of the Utah Republican Party, arguably the most thankless job in the state. Chairman Axon.
Hey, good to be with you guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah,
thanks for being here.
The first thing I asked him when he walked in was, are you regretting all of your life choices? And he just smiled at me.
Well, these are the moments. I mean, there's a lot of interest and things you do that are very interesting. But about a week or a week and a half ago, your life was thrown into disarray with a member of Congress stepping down. So explain to us a little bit about what this means. I mean, we're talking about general municipal elections, and we've talked a lot about that this morning. But this has a huge implication for the Republican Party because you now have a lot of jobs and responsibilities that you have to kind of fit in the cracks. So tell us about
exactly
what that
right.
looks like.
So you look, last week when we heard from Congressman Stewart that he was looking to resign, we knew based off of state law and as well as the need to have a voice and a vote back in Washington, D.C., that we would all need to really get things in order very quickly. Fortunately, the state has a pretty clear path on how to do that. As we looked at that over the last week, it became apparent that when you pass a law back in 2020 that was looking to the future of maybe someday this would be needed, you with very good intentions put kind of a framework in place. Now when it's coming to practice, we realize there's some particulars that were not accounted for. And so this is where the governor needed to call the legislature into a special session. They will be doing that next week to make some adjustments and to appropriate the funds necessary to conduct the election. And so I'm very grateful that they will be doing that. As it pertains to the party, there are many things that are outside of my control. I can't tell you since last night when the governor issued his proclamations and kind of the dates were laid out clearly and made public, I've had countless phone calls of folks wanting to know, so when is the party going to be hosting its election on the portion that we provide, which is a convention for the CD2 delegates? I don't have that date specific yet that I can announce, but it will be coming in very short order. We're trying to work through a number of considerations. And what I'm trying to do is balance, of course, the needs of the party, and that is to vet and conduct a process that's fair and transparent, but also take into account the need for delegates and Republicans at large across the state, but especially there in that district, to know that they can be engaged in the process. And so I want to make sure that we have a good turnout and participation.
And I also just figured out, I think, this morning. So I want to be clear, all of this makes me smile. Like, not that your life is hard, but
smiling
I'm like,
at Robert's expense.
No, I beg your pardon. What I mean is that, wow, it's really complicated. Because
yep.
I legit just thought, oh, he will step down and the delegates from CD2 will pick the replacement. Like, I just totally thought that's how we would do it, right? I wasn't really tracking all the rules. So, but I only just figured out this morning that there's even a signature gathering phase. So I was like, oh, we're like all in on all the things in a really short order.
About this. First and foremost, and this is important for everybody to understand, and I think this is a good civics lesson 101. the role of being a member of the House of Representatives is a constitutionally clearly, I mean, it's Article I, right? So it's a constitutionally dictated position, but it's the only position in our Constitution that there is no means to replace that individual through appointment or anything else but by election. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that our founders focused on the need to have an accountable body of our government that was most accountable to all of us. And so because of that, we have to conduct an election. The party can't just say, oh, well, here's our pick to fill the remainder of Congressman Stewart's seat. We need to face the electorate and go through that process. Then second to that is state law. And in state law, they allow for the nomination process of the parties to go through that dual path. And this gets back to the SB 54 discussions we've had over the last decade. You have what would be the delegate or convention path, which I will help facilitate. And then you will have the signature path, which the individual candidates will need to go and secure and verify that threshold of signatures within the second congressional district in order to gain access to the primary ballot.
Many of which may do both.
Yep. Yep. They absolutely could. You could have a delegate or a candidate that decides to go through one path or the other or through both. And I would imagine quite a few will look at the doing both, but that's up to them to decide.
Now, can I ask the hard question?
Oh, please.
Oh, well,
do.
There's all sorts of hard questions we can ask. Where? I mean, because the second congressional district, it's Davis County and all the way down to Washington County, right?
This is
I mean,
big this district.
Is
very,
huge. So it's
very
not like,
district.
Well, you just you pick something right in the middle. Well, right in the middle is what, like Richfield?
Yeah, I mean, so Richfield is probably one of the closest in the middle. I'll tell you, with the exception of a couple of states who have such low population that they only have one congressional seat for the entirety of the state. So, with the exception of those states like Alaska and Wyoming. I believe that this congressional district, as well as Congressman Curtis's, are two of the three or four largest geographic congressional districts in the entire United States. And so when you look at that, it becomes very complex. And this is where I'm going to have to thread the needle on this. The window of time that I will have to conduct the convention, it may seem big on surface that there's a handful of days. But keep in mind, if it's a work day and people are getting out of work around 5 o'clock, and this process is going to take between 3 and more likely closer to 4 hours. I can't have them traveling all the way from St. George up to Salt Lake or all the way from Salt Lake down to St. George. There's just not enough time unless we want to conduct an election at 11 p.m. at night through 3 in the morning, which I don't think we do. So we really have to go towards the weekends.
Can I ask you a question? And maybe there's a really obvious answer that I'm just not seeing, but you just don't want to Zoom this convention? Because I feel like what you just said, it's a huge district. We all learned during COVID how to get on a Zoom, and I don't know, it could be Skype or, you know, I'm not trying to be like promoting Zoom, but is there any option for that, or is that outside of your rules to even vote that?
Technically, there would be the ability to facilitate that. Then there becomes two questions. One is logistical. It is a very complex process to do that remotely and to do it through technological means. That one's not as concerning to me. The other consideration that is a concern to me is the practical and really how engaging of a process is it to have a voter or a delegate look that candidate in the eye, talk to them person to person instead of just watching a video or seeing a Zoom call. And I believe that as Americans, we all need to step up. And when we look at how much time is being asked of us, so for example, caucus night, some folks say, you know, caucus night, that takes me 2 hours. In my mind, 2 hours every 2 years is a pretty low bar and a pretty small price to pay for all the freedoms that I get here in this country. And so I want to facilitate a process that engages people. And it might be a delegate who's relatively new to the process, that this is the fire that they need that motivates them to be more engaged, to run for city council or whatever it may be. That we should always lean into as Americans.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, I like that answer. That was good.
It is. And you know, I don't think people... I appreciate the level of complexity. In fact, when I served as the party chair, there was, for a number of reasons that I just don't have time to go into, we had to move the primary. Did you remember that?
And, well, one big reason, COVID.
Well, there's that too. Right. But I mean, the number of things, I mean, I sort of jokingly said to the clerks as a group, well, how hard can it be? And they went, oh my goodness. And they showed me this list of all. Yeah, it's basically, here's the 73 things that have to be done and come into play for this to work out. So you... As the chairman of the Republican Party, Rob, you have to deal with that.
Yep.
You have to deal with party bylaws. You have to deal with both federal and state law.
Correct.
And somehow thread the needle with all of them. So in other words, you have a Herculean task that is darn near impossible, yep, which is why they pay you the big bucks.
Oh, absolutely.
And by big
I'm excited
bucks,
for
I mean
those.
No
Nothing.
Bucks
yeah,
at all.
It's a volunteer job, but you're still smiling, so I'm impressed.
Well, and here's the reason. We're lucky to live in this country, and I'll get back to that again. Like, this entire process where we get to pick the men and women who stand up and represent us, that's something that we should always be grateful for and allow it to dictate not only our enthusiasm to solve complex issues like we are now, but also maybe give us patience with people when we disagree with them or when it's not exactly the way that we want it to go.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Robert Axon, tired but smiling, Utah Republican Party chair. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
We've got more Inside Sources coming up after the break.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources. You're here with me, Leah Murray, and my good friend Derek Brown as we chatted about all the interesting things that are happening. Oh, my gosh.
And with interesting people who are making them happen or
fabulous.
Having to react to them.
Right. So I want to kind of like pivot our conversation here, Derek, to go national a little bit. I saw a poll that from News Nation and Decision Desk HQ polling voters, and they've got in this data 49% saying they would consider a third party candidate if it's a Trump-Biden race. What do you think?
You know what? I think there is just this collective panic, I think, in America of having just a redux of 2020 going through that all again. Although the interesting thing is the more the polling comes out and we keep thinking, okay, something's going to shift. It doesn't shift. It still looks like from the Republican standpoint, Donald Trump has the advantage. And with more and more people jumping into the Republican side, I mean, I think that further solidifies him, right? Because right. he has a base, and then you have all these others who are jumping in that I think, you know, they may have their individual constituencies, but none as large as his. So why don't we talk a little bit about who that is,
right.
and what that looks like?
Yeah, so we've got with us today Nathaniel Rakich, who is the Senior Elections Analyst at 538. Welcome to the show, Nathaniel.
Hey, guys. Thank you.
So my first question, as an avid fan of 538 and your podcast, and maybe you don't want to answer this, is that a good use of polling? Like, so when I started and I said News Nation, blah, 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 am I doing it right or should I be better? Teach me.
I'm afraid that is not a very good use of polling.
That's okay. Tell us why. Tell us why.
So, you know, the issue is that, you know, it's all nice and well for everybody to say, you know, oh, I would like a third party candidate, but people don't agree on what that third party candidate is, right? Some people might be conservatives who don't love Donald Trump. They're looking for someone who isn't Trumpy but is conservative. You might have some Democrats who think Biden is too old or not progressive enough. They're looking for progressive. There might be some people who are looking for a true moderate, someone in the middle of the road. And so that 49% really kind of starts to break down at that point. And then, you know, you just have the fact that, you know, you're going to have two very powerful parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. They've been the dominant parties in this country for 150 years. They're the big names on the ballot. Nobody wants their vote to go to waste. So even at the beginning of the campaign, if, you know, you have an independent candidate who's polling, say, 20% in the polls, as it gets closer and closer to election day, you always see in the polls that person always loses support as people kind of chicken out, if you will. And then, you know, they end up getting something like 5% or whatever. So, you know, there is definitely dissatisfaction with Biden and Trump. I don't want to minimize that. But the odds that a third party candidate will succeed or even get a meaningful share of the vote are very low.
And to some degree that this is also a money game. And one of the things, I mean, Nathaniel, I was one of the RNC, one of the three votes here in Utah as the chair for one of the elections right after 2020 when they elected their new leadership, when Ronald McDaniel was reelected. And it became really clear to me that Donald Trump still had the control of the fundraising levers in the party. And I'm assuming for Biden, it's the same thing. And so the ability for any of these candidates to sort of leapfrog and grab that nomination seems just almost impossible. And so I think in light of that, I think also a third party, just it might be interesting to talk about, but not necessarily anything that realistically could happen.
Yeah, absolutely. You just get so many advantages, you know, within the, and speaking just about the, you know, the primaries now, you know, when you are the incumbent president, obviously, you know, the DNC is never going to sanction even a debate. You know, they're not going to let any of Biden's challengers debate Biden because he's their guy. And on the Republican side, obviously, you have a debate, but Donald Trump is still, you know, he's an ex-president. So he has a lot of those same advantages, like you mentioned, the money, the name recognition, the loyalty that he's built up over 4 years or over his 4 years in office.
All right. So talk to us. Doing polling well. So do it better than I did, Nathaniel. Who is polling the best on the Republican side? And is there anybody, I love what you just said, they're not even going to let him debate, which I get why they wouldn't let Biden debate, but who maybe is polling well over on the Democratic side?
Yeah, well, I can knock out the Democrats first. So, you know, Biden obviously is polling the best. He's, you know, at like 60 or 70%. You do have kind of a sizable protest vote in terms of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is RFK's son, obviously, and also Marianne Williamson. They RFK has been getting as many as like 20% in some polls. That said, a lot of Democrats just don't know who he is, and they see the name Kennedy, and they're like, oh, I like the Kennedys, and they just pick him. He has a lot of more extreme fringe views, like he's very skeptical of vaccines. He's been sympathetic to Russia, for example. So, you know, in the event that, you know, they're actually kind of getting down on the campaign trail and Democrats learn about his stances, I think that that support's going to go down. On the Republican side, you know, it is a bit more competitive. Donald Trump in our 538 polling average is at 54% nationally, which isn't quite as high as Biden, but it's still obviously a strong position. It's a majority of voters. Ron DeSantis is around 21%. So, you know, he's in a kind of a position where he's within striking distance. You know, if Donald Trump were to collapse, let's say he gets, you know, indicted again, and maybe Republicans decide, Republican voters decide, or Republican elites decide that he's kind of too much trouble, too much baggage, and they decide to cast him aside, then Ron DeSantis is well positioned to take advantage of that. A lot of Republicans who like Donald Trump also like Ron DeSantis, so it wouldn't be a huge shift for them to go over from Trump to DeSantis. But again, you know, Donald Trump has been the standard bearer of the Republican Party for, you know, what, 7 years now. You know, they haven't abandoned him yet, despite numerous scandals. So I think the smart money is that they're going to stick with him.
So, Nathaniel, talk to us a moment about Mike Pence. We just talked about him. There was a CNN town hall about him. He was actually here in Utah about a month ago. Does he, you know, is there any chance that he's able to be sort of the third pick, or is it just, you know, it just seems kind of like a lackluster campaign? And to me, it strikes me as someone without a natural constituency, because the folks that love Donald Trump are not happy with him because of his, you know, the things he said about the president. And those who don't like the president really don't like Mike Pence either, because he was part of that administration. So, I mean, does he have a shot at all?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. You know, I don't want to say that he has zero shot, but it's definitely a very long shot. You know, he's the alternative to the alternative, right? So he's not only betting that Donald Trump is going to collapse, but he also needs Ron DeSantis to collapse. And so currently he's polling at 5%, which obviously is not very strong. And it's particularly bad when you consider that this isn't kind of some maybe fresh face in the party, somebody who people haven't heard of, but who has potential to grow, somebody like Barack Obama for Democrats in 2008, right? This is somebody who was vice president. Republicans know who he is, and they've basically decided they don't like him, or at least they're lukewarm about him. And this, of course, is because he broke with Donald Trump after January 6th by refusing to overturn the 2020 election. Basically, you know, there is this pool of Republicans, about 75% of them, who support either Trump or DeSantis. Those Republicans have an appetite for kind of a more pugnacious brand of conservatism. And I think those people maybe are flexible between Trump and DeSantis, but I think it's a little harder for them to go with someone more mild-mannered like Pence.
All right, Nathaniel, so we know, right, I hear you, and we are totally fully expecting who's going to be the nominees, but are there any other names or underdogs that you're kind of tracking or paying attention to?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think anybody other than Trump and maybe DeSantis are unlikely to be the Republican nominee. But two names, you know, that I'll mention just as, you know, maybe they'll have a bit of a moment. You know, they'll be a little dark horse at some point in the campaign. I think Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina has a lot of potential. He's got $20 million in the bank. You know, you were mentioning the money earlier. You know, that cash can go, you know, pretty far. He's got a compelling life story. He's the only Black Republican in the Senate. And I think a lot of Republicans wouldn't mind nominating a Black man to show, kind of prove to Democrats that they're not a racist party, as they've been accused of being. And then I also think that North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum is an interesting choice. He's a businessman, but he also has political experience. He's coming in. He's one of these people who I mentioned before, who's coming in with basically no national profile. His name recognition is something only like 20% nationally, but he is independently wealthy. He started a software company that he sold to Microsoft for $1 billion. So he's another person who can pour in a lot of money into his campaign. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to, you know, see him rise in the polls. Now, you know, of course, getting to 10% is maybe easy if you spend a few million dollars, but getting to 50% Donald Trump, that's going to be hard.
Exactly. All
Nathaniel
right.
Nathaniel Rakic, senior elections analyst at 538. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, fallout continues after a Ukrainian dam was heavily damaged this week from an explosion. Might be putting a strain on Russia's relationship with China. Why? We'll find out next.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
We have with us Mark Toth, economist, entrepreneur, and former board member of the World Trade Center St. Louis, to have a conversation about what's going on in Ukraine. So I think, Mark, for the first thing I want to ask you is, for our listeners who may not have been paying attention the last couple of days, what is happening in Ukraine with their dam?
Quite a bit. It's gone. At least a major one that's on the River Dnipro in the Zaporizhzhia Oblast. And while there's some technical doubt as to who did it, it's clear. The Russians did it. The Russians have controlled that dam since, you know, near the beginning of the war. And by my eye, I have some commercial real estate background, so I've dealt with engineers and structural types. It was an implosion. So it came from within inside. Clearly, the Russians were controlling the inside of the structure. The other damage, which there's been some speculation about, it's basically water damage. People are like, well, you know, how did those things move further down the dam? But that was just the force of the water taking them. So huge, huge incident. And, you know, while the speculation continues as to who caused it, I think that's just for people to dot their I's and cross their T's. It's clear to me that the Russians did it.
So, Mark, one of the interesting things here is you would think that Russia, if in fact they were the ones responsible for this, would have provided some notice, right, to their troops, because I was reading that apparently one news article said that the Kremlin's own troops, and I'm quoting now, the Kremlin's own troops were washed away, their trenches flooded, accommodation inundated, and as they ran in the open to save themselves, Ukrainian forces rained death down upon them from the opposite bank of the river. So either the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing, or this seems like just a terrible blunder on the Russians' part, because rather than letting their troops know, hey, this is coming, get out, it sounds like they lost a lot of Russian lives in addition to just the ecological disaster that's going to take place in that area.
Right. I mean, you're spot on, Derek. There's a couple things going on there. You know, the first is that Russia does not value the lives of its troops. This is something that we've seen going all the way back to World War II. They basically are cannon fodder in the minds of their commanding generals. So it's not surprising that the Russian troops were caught there. You know, it's to be expected, because in their minds, and again, it's foolish thinking, in their minds, well, we can catch the Ukrainians off guard, and so what if it kills a bunch of our guys that, you know, are pre-positioned there? But there's just so much more that's problematic with what their decision was. It's one thing to blow it, even though it's still a war crime to do it in the way that they did it, but they did it pre any massive movement of Ukrainian troops. So to do it as prematurely as they did had no real value and has now created ecological and water issues for them in Crimea itself. It's just foolish. The other thing that's going on is, in terms of the reactions that you were reading about from the Russian soldiers, is another article that John and I had written about the Ukrainians, and we wrote this actually in The Messenger. The Ukrainians are coming. I'm sorry, Colonel John Sweet, who I co-write with, we wrote this piece. The Russians right now are seeing Ukrainians everywhere. They're like the boogeyman that the minute, you know, any of these conscripts, these very poorly trained soldiers, you know, see any Ukrainians, you'd think it's, you know, Genghis Khan's army coming at them. So you've got those two factors coming into play here.
So, Mark, I appreciate very much you mentioning Jonathan Sweet, who you write with, because we're looking at your article from today. So I want to just pivot to that, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
You're talking about, so there's ecological impacts and there's like strategic reasons you may or may not have done like they did with the dam. But you've got a really interesting piece about what this does with the relationship with China. So can you just talk us through that?
Sure. I think in the scheme of things, and again, it's hard to know for sure, but I think in the scheme of things with Chinese President Xi Jinping, is he would have preferred none of this to happen to begin with, but it did. And so given that it's ongoing, he's kind of viewed to date Putin as a useful idiot, you know, on several levels. Putin can weaken the West in advance of any machinations that he might have, military ones on Taiwan down the road, as well as use Russia as a cheap gas station to get his oil and energy needs. And it's kind of ironic because several years back, Putin himself said proudly when he was announcing the high-tech initiatives that Russia was going to be embarking upon, that Russia was no longer going to be a gas station. Well, the net effect of his wars, that's what he's turned the country's economy into.
So what's interesting now is kind of where this goes. And Mark, one of the things you mentioned is that his patience with Putin is likely nearing an end. So talk to us about that. I mean, do you think this is creating a rift between those two leaders that in theory could benefit the West? Or, you know, where does this go?
Yeah, I think you've got to think of Xi. And, you know, despite all the bellicosity coming out of that country, they're still technicians at heart. And the core of their economic plan, their master plan to rule the world, if you will, is their Belt and Road Initiative, what's commonly known as BRI. And there are some estimates by economists that's going to be up to $7 trillion, maybe even $8 trillion in total value. And that extends all the way from China. That's creating green technology roads, you know, kind of a modern version, if you will, of the Silk Road that once connected China to, you know, medieval and Europe. And that's at risk now. Putin's putting that at risk. It's one thing to be fighting in Ukraine. It's another thing to be creating ecological disasters that is going to get all of Europe upset with him for backing Putin. So from that standpoint, you know, they've got a lot on the table. The EU itself is a major trading partner with China. The EU exports 8% and imports 20% of its own products from China. That's a market, you know, Beijing can't lose. So they are nearing an end. And I think these ecological tipping points, like what we've seen with the Kakhovka Dam there, you know, on the Dnipro being blown up, I think that's going to cause a rupture sooner than later.
All right. So, Mark, in the last minute that we have, just pivoting back to Ukraine, what are you expecting to see? What are you watching for? Are there any signs of Ukraine's counteroffensive? Like, what are we looking for there?
Yeah, I think we're still in the probing phase, but probing with force. I know there's a lot of reporting out. I don't believe, and John and I talked about this before I got on, I don't believe that what we're seeing yet is a full-on counteroffensive. And the reason we say that and conclude that, for instance, there's a video circulating today that the Russians are touting of a major pushback, you know, of the counteroffensive, but it was only company size. We're talking 100 men. There were two Leopards. There was a couple of APCs, probably M113s, and maybe 100 men in total surrounding that. What we're not seeing that you would expect to see in a large-scale counteroffensive is you know, air defense, air operations, supporting artillery, deep strikes coming in over their heads to clear the way, along with engineers who, you know, are clearing pathways and the like. What we saw was basically a probe, you know, a small sized company testing Russian defenses to see where the strengths, where the weaknesses are, you know, where they can break through and what they should avoid and go around.
Fantastic. Well, we thank you, Mark. We appreciate you joining us. We've had Mark Toth, who wrote a fantastic piece today in The Hill, specifically about Ukraine, China, and this ecological disaster that's taking place with the dam that has been blown up. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it both, Leah and Derek.
All right. So Derek has got feelings about passports, and we're going to get into it.
Imagine that.
After the break.
Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources. You're here with me, Leah Murray, and my friend Derek Brown, who, like our senator, has some feelings about the passports. So because we just had that right before we came in, Derek, I think it's all right to talk about listening to what Senator Romney said about why this issue should be looked at.
This day and age, I think it's unreasonable to expect Americans to think it's going to take them months to get a passport, particularly a passport renewal, because they can, if they apply for a credit card where they're going to get thousands of dollars of credit from a bank, they can get the card in days. And yet an American citizen who's had a passport for 50 years can wait months and months to get a passport. It just doesn't make sense.
So what do you think, Derek?
Well, can I rant? Is this the appropriate time of the show where we rant?
No, you have to be elevated conversation.
Elevated. How about an elevated rant?
There you
okay,
go.
So one of the things we're going to do here at KSL is inform our listeners of something they may not be aware of. But the reality is there's a couple things you need to know. First of all, if your passport expires within 6 months from now, you can't leave the country. I don't think most people know that. And in fact, one of the calls I get most frequently from friends and family members dealing with the government, and this is probably because I've worked in a senator's office on a number of occasions, is can you help me with a passport?
Right.
Now, in the good old days, there were expedited ways of doing it in a couple of days. But for some reason, the passport center for the United States government is not just unreasonably slow, it is unacceptably slow. And this is not just my anti-government rant. This is like it's just completely absurd and it takes forever. And can I give you an example, Leah?
Yes, please.
So everyone needs to know that it takes at a minimum 12 weeks just to renew your passport. So if you're planning on leaving the country, where were you, June? If you're planning on leaving the country, say, before the 8th of September, and you need a renewal on your passport, and I know there's probably a lot of you out there who are listening thinking this very thing, I'm telling you, it's not going to happen. That's what's going on. In fact, here's a little anecdote. I had some friends that called me last week, a mom and dad who were going to Cancun on a vacation that they'd planned out for a long time. Their kids needed passport renewals. And actually, it was more than 6 months out, but they thought, you know what, we might as well just do it. Let's get them all done. So the parents had passports. The kids didn't. They applied well over 3 months ago, and they still didn't have their passports.
Right.
And so, in fact, they called Senator Mike Lee's office, and they came back. And one of the interesting things, and you'll get a kick out of this, Leah, is apparently for kids, you only need a birth certificate to go across the border. For the adults, you need the passport. So because the passport agency had taken 13 weeks and they still hadn't got just the basic renewals back, they flew from here to San Diego, crossed the border with their kids to Tijuana, took a flight from Tijuana to Cancun, and that's how they're coming back.
Right, to just get around.
Just to get around it. And
issue,
it's not
right.
like they waited until the last
no,
second.
Right.
I mean, they planned 3 months in advance. So I know there is someone out there listening going, oh boy. And the reality is if you are in a panic mode because you're less than 3 months out and need a passport, you know, I'm really sorry, but you need to jump on it and you need to know that the likelihood of getting your passport here by, you know, the 8th of September is almost non-existent.
Right. And if you're someone like me who I have passports and my children have passports and I renew them when they need to be renewed, you know, because I'm just never knowing when I'm going to travel. So I am just ready, right? I'm not getting a passport up against a trip that I'm having. I'll just have these passports. But one of the issues I thought was interesting here, because I grew up on the East Coast, Derek, and I grew up near New York City, which was a passport location, that actually San Diego's where you have to go, right? Like we're not close to a passport, like an office that you could get help with, right?
There's not one here in Salt Lake.
Right. So Senator Romney talked about that.
But also hope that there's a way to increase staffing. Perhaps, I mean, I'd like to build offices with physical presence, but perhaps at least pilot projects of some kind that allow us to have individuals surged in areas like Salt Lake City or somewhere in the Intermountain West, Boise or wherever, where we can get services for people in the Intermountain West without having to drive as many as 8 hours for the needs for in-person views.
Right, because the issue is that is actually really far away. Does that make sense?
It is.
Adds a trip to get to be able to go on your trip.
And I can tell you a dozen times of people that I know in the past. I mean, it's so slow now. It's just unacceptable. But in the past, it's still been unacceptably slow, but not quite as slow. But because of that, I know of a dozen people who, in fact, a good friend of mine last year was leaving the country. And his passport had just expired, and he went, oh, no, what do I do? He found an appointment in the San Diego office the next day, so he flew to San Diego, got his passport, flew back here, and then took his flight. And that happens all the time. San Diego, Denver, Dallas. I mean, I can't tell you how often it happens where someone will fly literally to San Diego for a passport and then back because there's no other option.
Right, and so Rena Bitter, who is the Assistant Secretary for State Bureau of Consular Affairs, responded to the senator's request this way.
Thank you for raising the issue of geographic divergences. It's something we really monitor a lot. We collect a lot of data on it. There are, you know, I can throw out statistics at you, which will be unsatisfying, but we think that the best way for us to be able to serve the American public is through modernizing our systems and being able to surge our hiring.
So I feel like that was a lot of words for no, right?
Classic bureaucrat ease for, right. You know, to say, well, we're monitoring the situation. It's getting worse and worse and worse, but don't worry. We're monitoring how bad it's getting.
But how do you feel about her answer, whether it's, you know, unacceptable or not, right, Derek? But the idea is she's saying for us to do this job well, actually the best way to do it is to modernize the system, have more labor instead of opening an office in Salt Lake City. Do you think she's right, or are we talking about you think it's a better idea to have offices just all across the country, which then to me might be even more inefficient maybe?
I think the answer is yes on both fronts. They
gotcha.
Absolutely need to modernize, no question about it. And when you travel and you see, you know, technology like Clear or even the visa entering, if you've come into the America, you know, recently from another country, you know, there's just a facial recognition. I mean, the technology is there, no doubt about it. Now, will more offices help? Here's the problem with passport. With a passport application, there's only so much I think you can do without an in-person component.
Right.
I'm saying you actually probably physically need to be present at some point in the process. But this is not hard. I mean, that's why, I mean, Senator Romney made the comment about, you know, you apply for a large credit card for tens of thousands of dollars and you can basically get it FedEx to you by the next day. I mean, there's no reason that this should take 12 to 13 months.
Right. But Derek, if I'm getting a credit card, that's from a private bank, which I would fully expect to be super efficient. Am I hearing you argue that the federal government should get really competent and efficient?
Oh, heavens forbid. Heaven forbid. Right. I don't know that we'd know what to do with that kind of thing.
I think you'd be very worried if that were true.
Exactly. So two points just to take away for those of you who just tuned in. Number one, if your passport is expiring within 6 months from now, you can't leave the country. So look at your passport if you have a trip coming up and be aware of that. And number two, if you're going somewhere within the next 12 to 13 weeks and you haven't applied to renew your passport and your passport is expired, you're probably in trouble as well. So not to be the bearer of gloom and doom, but here at KSL, we want to provide information that is helpful because when it comes to questions involving the federal government, I probably get this one more than any other single question.
Derek, it has been a pleasure spending 2 hours with you today. Thank you very much.
Likewise. Thank you, Leah.
Yeah. And for our listeners, thank you so much for being with us. I will see you tomorrow. Thank you for joining us on Inside Sources today. Don't go away. You're going to want to stick around for Jeff Kaplan's Afternoon News.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news.
I'm Dave Cauley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.